Chapter 8. Confrontation. By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Andy and I have returned to the new annex briefing room, made our report, and learned, by way of one of Jez's gophers, that the cleaning outfit is a subsidiary of G4S, and all the victims of the K-syndrome outbreak were indeed working in the same skyscraper, and furthermore were all on the night shift, which is excellent progress. Angleton has been called away to deal with some other bushfire. Lockhart's in the driving seat. Unfortunately, that's where the good news ends. The skyscraper in question, well, at 45 stories it's a skyscraper by British standards, is the headquarters of a major British financial institution. Indeed, a household name as prominent and honourable as Northern Rubble and Rat West. Unlike the aforementioned institutions, this one didn't end up in public ownership in 2008. But it's not somewhere we can just go barging into mob-handed without attracting all sorts of unwelcome attention, not to mention spooking the cultists. So we're going to have to deploy our minions' stealth and misdirection for this job.
"Can you handle a mop and bucket?"
asks Lockhart. "I don't know. Can you impersonate a bank manager?" I fire back, which is unkind and unfair because he always dresses the part. He looks at me with ill-concealed distaste.
"We've sorted you out a way in," he says. "They're currying a uniform over here right now. You're down on the roster as Sarah Sead's replacement on this evening's shift. Sarah's supervisor, Eva Carter, can show you where Mrs. Sead's body was found. Just try not to mess things up."
"What else?" I ask.
"You'll be wearing a wire, and the Oculus brick outside will be monitoring the feed from their truck. In event of trouble, you'll have 2 extraction paths. One is via the police. We'll have our liaison in SCO-1 ready to dispatch a team to arrest you if you get into trouble, and they'll be pre-briefed that you're doing a black bag job for SIS. The other is the Oculus team themselves, but we don't want to do that. Do you understand?"
I nod soberly. An Oculus extraction in Docklands would be visible all the way from 6 different TV studios and a couple of newspaper newsrooms. Nobody wants to be the subject matter of a Cobra briefing to the Prime Minister and Cabinet, due to the tower of smoke rising to the east of Downing Street. That kind of thing can be a career-limiting move, especially if the existence of the organisation you work for is a state secret the PM hasn't been cleared for. So, the availability of a full Oculus team outside the bank HQ isn't about rescuing my sorry ass if I run into something I can't handle. It's about saving London if it turns out there's the thaumaturgic equivalent of a nuke in the basement.
"Okay, I'd better go visit Harry," I say. "Page me when the G4S package arrives."
Harry the Horse is our in-house armourer. One-eyed, with a manner he acquired from studying The Long Good Friday, he's an ex-cop, or ex-soldier, or ex-something, that allowed him to acquire an alarming amount of expertise about killing people in the course of his profession. He hangs out in a cubbyhole in the basement, with a walk-in gun safe and a firing range. Don't ask me how he crammed a 100-metre-long underground firing range into the 60-metre-long basement of the new annex. It probably has something to do with ley lines and spatio-temporal distortion.
"Hello, my son," he says as I stick my head round the door. "What brings you down here today?"
"A code blue," I say, which gets his attention instantly. "I've got to go poke my nose around an office this evening. Police and Oculus back up outside, but it's a low-key investigation. We don't want to attract attention. So I need arms and armour for self-defence, but nothing I can't conceal inside a cleaner's overall."
"All right."
He puts down the copy of Grenade Fancier's Monthly he's reading and unlocks the vault door.
"Follow me."
Shortly thereafter, I'm equipped with a new extra-shiny protective ward and an ultra-thin anti-stab vest, breastplate and back protector suitable for wearing under outer layers.
"Can I interest you in a little something for the weekend?" he wheedles. "Just a little one."
"You know I don't like guns," I complain as Harry hauls out a Glock 17 in standard police spec. I rub my right upper arm. I don't have the upper arm strength to hold a pistol one-handed for long. Not since that business when the Wandsworth cell of the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh dined out on Bob's sashimi,
adding cannibalism to their charge sheet. The dent in my arm is a souvenir of the occasion. Also, in event of a police extraction, I really do not want them calling down SCO-19 on my ass by mistake. Those guys shoot first and ask questions later.
Well then, let me see.
Harry puts the Glock back and has a rummage in the drawers.
How about this?
He pulls out something that looks at first glance like a silver knuckle duster, until I see that it's only got one ring, with some sort of crown on it. Whatever it is, you're supposed to grip it in your fist.
What's that?
I ask.
Stunner. You wrap your hand round the battery and capacitor and punch, like so. But it's also a waveguide. See these markings?
I peer at the indicated runes.
Class 4 banishment charge. If someone tries to summon a nasty on your ass, this'll send it right back to where it came from.
Okay, that I like. I pick up the taser cum banishment charge. I think we're about done here. I'll just make sure my camera's got a full charge. It's a new one, a replacement for the one I totaled when we closed out Andy's office. And with that, I head back to the briefing room, where a package containing one G4S cleaner's uniform has arrived. Meanwhile...
Hello, this is Mary Murphy checking in. I'd like to speak to Alison White in Human Resources. Yes, I'll hold.
Mary reclines her chair and catches Oscar's eye. She nods minutely. He picks up the handset on his voice terminal and mutes it, then listens in.
Hi, Alison. Long time no see. Yes, I'm fine. How about you? How's Steve doing?
She listens for a while with appropriate verbal punctuation.
The reason I'm calling is I need a little favour. It's a laundry problem. I've stumbled over something unusual and I need your help in tidying it up.
It's 6 o'clock. I've had a very long day already, and I'm coming down in the world. That's the only reason I can think of why I'm standing here, keeping my mouth shut while a middle-aged shift boss bitches at me.
I don't believe this. I ask them for a replacement cleaner who has corporate experience, and they send me you. What are they thinking of in HR? You're useless.
She's pacing up and down in the breeze-block-walled janitorial room, pausing to periodically glare at me.
This is very exacting job. This customer is very critical. Why do they send me a man with no previous experience?
We've got off to a great flying start, Ava and me. I can empty bins, vacuum and dust, I offer. What more do you want?
You have no security pass.
Ava rounds on me.
Why have you not got a CRB check? You can't clean bank offices without CRB. It say here you don't have CRB.
She brandishes a dog-eared stack of forms at me. Oh, that! Of course I haven't been checked by the Criminal Records Bureau prior to employment by G4S Cleaning. I'm subject to developed vetting as a regular, recurring part of the security clearance for my job. As far as the CRB is concerned, I don't even exist. Will this do? I ask, hauling out my warrant card.
What?
Ava stops in mid-flow. You will see that this warrant card identifies me as a plainclothes detective inspector from the Metropolitan Police, I tell her, extemporizing on the spot. I am here as part of an official investigation by the Serious Fraud Office. You will not ask me any questions about why I am here or what I am doing. You will take me around the offices that Sarah Siad cleaned on her last shift. If anybody asks about me, I am a new trainee and you are showing me the ropes. Do you understand?
But...
She runs down after a few seconds.
We don't have trainees here.
Doesn't matter. They'll believe I'm a trainee if I tell them to. That's the beauty of the card. It's official ID with a Class 4 GESH attached. And as long as I'm using it on official business, it will draw on the full authority of the organization to convince anyone I present it to that I'm on, shall we say... whatever official business it is, in the best interests of the organization for them to believe I'm engaged in. The only people it won't fool are other laundry staff and seriously powerful sorcerers. I don't like using it on civilians, but it's less hassle than calling the ops room to yell at her boss, and more merciful than the other options I have up my sleeve. I need to see Sarah's route. This is official police business.
I'll take you there. Never heard such a thing.
She leads off, muttering to herself and periodically glancing back at me with angry-eyed suspicion, clearly disturbed by the impact my lack of office cleaning chops is going to have on her workload. I follow Ava into the maze of twisty little corridors and open-plan cubicle areas that comprise the back-office IT support section of the bank. There are no windows. We're below ground level here. But there's an omnipresent dull roar of air conditioning that paradoxically makes everything sound muted. I guess it swamps other noises. Most of the offices are relatively spartan and cheaply furnished. Employees with a status to rate a window view don't generally work down here, and it's largely deserted. The market's closing bell has long since rung, and most of the staff have long since gone home or buggered off to the wine bar. With a sinking feeling, I begin to wonder if I've left it too late, if the brain-eating phantasm I'm searching for comes and goes with the day shift. I have a smartphone loaded with our off-cut suite and a suitably Bluetoothy sensor, and I periodically check to see if it's picked up anything. But no, there's not so much as a haunted print server down here, much less a nest of Don't Be Silly Bob. Ava leads me past a familiar-looking door that screams Server Room at me. It's secured by a keypad, with warning notices and a breeze blowing from around it. I spot a prominent red handle under a Perspex cover, beside a notice warning of the risk of asphyxiation in event of a halon dump. I pause and check my off-cut readout again. There's a very faint yellow warning, barely budging the needle, but that's enough to get my attention.
"Why are you dawdling?" demands Ava, glaring at me. "We've got offices to clean."
The server room's reading barely above background level. I follow Ava along a corridor that leads past it. There are signs of new construction here. I see raw sections of wall punctuated by open panels where new cable runs are being installed, converging on a cabinet with a patch panel. And then there's a door with a sign on it, The Scrum, subtitled Keep Out. My thermometer, needless to say, is pointing straight towards it. Ava goes in. I make no judgment upon the Scrum at this point, other than to note that they clearly rate a much higher grade of office furniture than the janitorial and other staff who occupy the basements of the bank. The door opens on a room that looks like an outer office that's being turned into an access control corridor. There's a door at either end of it, and something that looks like a half-assembled airport metal detector gate, or perhaps an excessively paranoid retailer's anti-shoplifting gizmo standing between them, powered down and with neatly taped-up cables dangling beside an empty equipment rack. Curious, I think, and check my thermometer again. This time it's reading amber. I'm definitely not in Kansas anymore. "Are you getting this?" I mutter into my lapel. I'm in basement level B, office with a sign saying The Scrum on the door, and I'm getting a 3-sigma signal.
"Sarah cleaned in here yesterday," Ava tells me. "She was in the next office along. I thought she was asleep at first and was very angry, but she wasn't."
"You'd better go away," I tell her. "You don't need to clean in here tonight."
But you...
"Leave this suite and finish your round," I repeat. She gets the message after a moment, nods jerkily, then turns and leaves, nearly stomping on my foot as she goes. She takes the cleaning cart with her. There is the stench of the occult about this place. Something or someone is messing with the substrate of reality, and my magical mystery detector is picking up the overspill. It would be best to get some idea of what I'm up against before I open the next door. I take a deep breath, then do the close my eyes and open the other one thing, trying not to think how much I hate this. A few months ago I had to do it in a hotel suite in Colorado Springs. Two men, well, they'd started out as men, paid for it with their lives, using what was left of their souls as currency. I'm a necromancer, and the guy I'm apprenticed to isn't called the Eater of Souls for nothing. Against the dark background of my eyelids, the world around me is tinted with faintly luminous green blobs. X-ray vision for the occult. One of them moves. "Who are you, and what do you think you're doing there? Who let you in?" I open my eyes. A skinny guy, in an ill-fitting but clearly expensive suit, has just come through the door at the other end of the room, and is staring at me with an oddly intent expression, like a ferret sizing up a rat for breakfast. He's not ugly, but he can't be much past his early 20s, and the skin around his jawline is cratered with the extinct volcanic debris of late adolescent acne. My inner eye pegs him for a practitioner the instant I clap eyes on him. I hold up my warrant card and smile cynically. "Serious fraud office, my son. What's your story?"
"Oh, God. Oh, no. Oh, God, oh!"
He starts off on a very promising meltdown. It's quite gratifying to watch, for about the first 3 seconds as he stumbles towards me. But then he trips over his own tongue, and, as he comes forward, focuses on my ID and does a double take.
"Wait, that's not a..."
He straightens up, and I do a double take as I realise he's way too close. He comes at me, raising one arm to grab the card. I pull it back out of reach, and we do a clumsy two-step for a moment, which ends up with him grabbing my right arm. Despite looking like a weed, he grips like he's been taking arm wrestling lessons from an industrial robot. Whether by design or by accident, he's got hold of my bad bicep.
"Hey!"
I squawk involuntarily, stick my left hand in my pocket, and pull out Harry's nasty little gadget.
"Let go!" "Are you a journalist?"
he demands.
"What are you doing here? What are you looking for?"
"Let go now," I warn him. And that's when he realizes I've got something in my left hand.
"Identify yourself."
He loosens his grip, as if it's dawning on him that it might be foolhardy to grab an intruder waving a warrant card and claiming to be a cop. I hold the zapper against his stomach, but don't push the button.
"You're not SFO,"
he accuses.
"I'm asking the questions. Who are you?"
"Alex Schwartz. That's Dr. Alex Schwartz to you. You're making a big mistake busting in here. We have security."
"Jolly good, Dr. Schwartz. Is this your office suite?"
"You're making a..."
"Because if so, I think we ought to sit down, de-escalate this, and have a little heart-to-heart."
"But you're making a..."
He backs up a few centimetres, then a few more, until he's moving towards the inner door.
"Mistake! We don't have anything to do with money here. We're the algorithm development support group for the quantitative trading desks. We don't actually have anything to do with..."
Picture a light bulb going on over my head, and make it a 5 million lumen floodlight.
"Blood," I say,
which is exactly the worst possible thing that could come out of my mouth at that moment. Alex's pupils dilate and he grimaces, lips pulling back from his teeth. He begins to lean towards me, and the ward on the silver chain I'm wearing under my shirt suddenly heats up painfully and begins to throb.
"Freeze," he says. "Be calm. Everything is all right."
Leaning closer, he reaches towards my shoulders.
"Everything is... Ouch!"
50,000 volts of happy juice throws him halfway across the room, flailing and twitching. I yank the camera out of my other pocket, whimpering slightly as I put too much effort into my right arm, and hit the power button. The rear screen lights up gratifyingly fast. I step over Alex while he's busy twitching, and kick the inner door open, basilisk device raised and ready. I get a moment to gawp at the Scrum's lair. There's a big open-plan office with glass-fronted smaller offices opening off it to all sides, and directly opposite me there's a huge whiteboard covered in multicoloured post-it notes. And that's all I get before a spike-haired woman in a black trouser suit leaps out from behind the door I just opened and does something extremely painful to my right wrist, at which point I drop the camera, scream, and reflexively try to eat her soul. Ever get that sensation when you bit into a pitted olive and discovered a stone? Keep a grip on that feeling. Now, imagine that instead of doing it with your teeth, you just did it with your brain. While I'm staggering in sudden agony, Spikey, the Wonder Banker, yanks my arm round into a half-Nelson and snarls,
"Krav Maga, baby! I knew that self-defense course would come in handy sooner or later!"
Then she gives me the bum's rush towards the boardroom at the opposite end of the office. It's like she didn't even feel my attempt at killing her. I'm still processing the oh-shit moment and winding up to kill her to death all over again. Why didn't it work the first time? A little corner of me is gibbering. When my feet touch the ground, and I see what's in front of me, and the bottom drops out of my universe. Two office workers, one male and one female, are sitting opposite me at the far end of a boardroom table. The woman looks worryingly familiar.
"Bob,"
she says,
while her companion, an intense-looking bald guy in heavy horn-rimmed spectacles, is working his way up to a puzzled expression.
"What on earth do you think you're doing here?
Put him down, Janice. How often do I have to tell you it's bad manners to play with your food?" Then she gives me a familiar and half-contemptuous smile that tells me in no uncertain terms that A, my fly is at half-mast, B, she can see right through me, and C, I'm fucked.
"Mary?"
I ask. Then Dr. Schwartz grabs me by the opposite arm with an inarticulate growl.
"No, Alex, do not rip his head off,"
Mary says irritably.
"Both of you, back off. Sit him down at the table and give him a bottle of Perrier. We've got a lot of forms to fill out."
She taps a pile of papers in front of her suggestively and glances sidelong at Intensity Boy, who nods, then stares at me with pursed lips. They're all staring at me. I'm getting a horrible sinking feeling, because Intensity Boy is exchanging knowing looks with Mary in a manner suggestive of mutual understanding, while Janice and Alex are breathing down my neck and sizing each other up like I'm the last slice of pizza in the Hunger Games. Well, fuck me sideways with a wooden stake, I realise dismally. I've fallen in a wunch of vampires. My experience of Mary, albeit a decade out of date, leads me to believe that anyone who can see eye to eye with her like that is quite possibly as batshit crazy as she is. Now her partner in crime opens his mouth.
"I'm sure you're wondering what this is all about," he says calmly. "Chair, Alex. Where are your good manners?"
Janice is still holding me with a grip like a JCB. Alex grudgingly pulls a chair out from the table and shoves it under my arse, while Janice pushes me down onto it until my knees buckle. Somewhere along the way, the camera ends up on the table. Ha ha, very funny. It's like an anxiety dream. You know the kind where you find yourself sitting an exam in the school gym hall again, and you're naked? This is the other one, the adult workplace version, where you're hauled up before a committee for a damning performance appraisal, and it's chaired by your psycho ex from hell. And the rest of the committee are vampires or something.
"Mary, if you could explain, this is sufficiently unfamiliar that I do not want to risk misstating the situation."
"It may be unfamiliar, but it's very simple, Oscar."
Mary glances at him again, almost fondly, which by itself almost makes me lose my lunch, then turns back to me. The past years have been good for her, insofar as she seems to have grown some kind of glossy, high-powered captain of industry shell, with added stingers and venom glands.
"Whatever fire drill you've called, you can damn well call it off, Bob, because we're all colleagues here."
She hauls out a suspiciously shiny-looking card wallet and flips it across the table at me. It's a warrant card. It's got her name and a rather out-of-date photograph on it. I pick it up and turn it over, and it tingles just right, as indeed it should. In the small print, the "valid from" field contains today's date. I flick it back towards her. It stops halfway, then starts again, gradually picking up speed until it whizzes back into her hand. That's a new feature, I note absently. Mine doesn't do that. She pats the pile of paperwork by her elbow.
"Actually, it's a good thing you turned up. Now you're here, you can make yourself useful by helping me fill out their in-processing assessments for HR. Alison White is expecting them on her desk at 9 o'clock sharp to begin induction profiling."
But...
I force myself to stop flapping.
"You can't unilaterally recruit them. They're vampires. You're all vampires."
Mary looks at me pityingly.
"Nonsense, Bob. Everybody knows vampires don't exist. They're just extremely gifted mathematicians who have pioneered a new and fertile area of category theory that is undoubtedly of interest to the organisation. I'd be the last to deny that there have been some odd side effects, but if you keep insisting your new co-workers are mythical monsters, you'll have only yourself to blame when HR starts to question your sanity."
We all make mistakes. In our youth, if we survive them, they're called learning experiences, or teachable moments, or some such. And that which does not maim or kill us usually makes us stronger, albeit sometimes also sadder and more cynical. Mary was one of my learning experiences. I'm not sure what I was, from her side of the looking glass. Roadkill, perhaps? Or a useful idiot? Something like that. But let's not go there. Rewind to the late 90s/early noughties. There's me, Bob Howard, working on a postgrad CS degree. This means I'm putting in roughly 80 hours a week on the books and in front of the computer screen, in a field where the proportion of women is roughly what you'd expect of a 16th century Benedictine monastery. I was, not to put too fine a point on it, single. I then managed to bring myself to the attention of the laundry by means too embarrassing to relate. Well, okay. I nearly landscaped Wolverhampton by accident, because that's what happens when your funky new real-time rendering algorithm that uses a really neat logical shortcut you can't believe nobody invented before turns out to be an open and ungrounded summoning grid, which is the extra-dimensional equivalent of a fast food joint with a buzzing neon sign that says, "Good eats here. Can we move on, please?" So, the organisation made me a job offer I couldn't, wasn't allowed to, refuse. And then they stuck me behind a desk to rot for a few years, or at least until I'd been thoroughly studied and quantified and got sufficiently bored to ask for something more interesting to do instead. During which period I found myself working elbow to elbow with a whole raft of people I wouldn't otherwise have met, mostly in similar straits. They saw something uncanny, heard something go bump in the night, and got swept up in the dragnet when they were found to be useful, some of whom had no Y chromosomes and were also single. Like I said, Mary was a learning experience for me. Do you really want to hear about our doomed on-again, off-again car crash relationship? The immediate nature of the teachable moment for little old 20-something me was, as a drunken friend of mine questionably phrased it some time later, "Do not stick your dick in the bad crazy." It took a lot longer, and a whole lot more perspective, not to mention being married for several years to someone who most certainly was not the bad crazy, for me to work out what was actually going on in our dysfunctional relationship, which alternated between bouts of hot primal monkey sex and screaming pan-throwing arguments. What I think was happening was that the me that Mary was alternately fucking and throwing things at was not me, but some sort of demented revenge rebound placeholder for a previous boyfriend of many years and some commitment. She'd split up with him acrimoniously less than 6 months before we first so much as snogged, and he'd done a beautiful gaslight number on her in the process. Either that, or she was bipolar with a topping of psycho special sauce. But resentful rebound relationships are a hell of a lot commoner, and I'll go with Occam's razor this time. The net result was that she was a walking bomb, primed to take out all her existential resentment on whatever man she next took up with, because Bill, I think he was a Bill, had convinced her that all men were fundamentally untrustworthy bastards who would lie to her at the drop of a hat. And I, having recently emerged blinking into the light from a quasi-monastic existence, was simply a convenient cuddly punch bag. Basically, our relationship was doomed to be toxic from the get-go, if only I had possessed the experience to recognise it. Luckily, well, I got lucky. I met Mo, and then had a decade-long healing and maturation process, because Mo was both older and smarter than me, and patient enough to wait for me to get my head out of my arse. As for Mary, her instability got back to HR, who politely offered her an outplacement, sworn to secrecy on a permanent sabbatical, file marked "Do not reactivate except in case of emergency," and discreet help in building a new life that didn't press all her broken buttons on a daily basis by rubbing her nose in the transience and irrationality of human life and the underlying horror of the things waiting for us at the bottom of the world. So picture my joy at walking into that boardroom and being smiled at by my toxic ex from hell, in blonde highlights and a black suit with sharp shoulder pads, a pile of HR forms on hand for me to countersign, and the assurance that once again I'd be working with her. No, time does not heal all wounds. Phone calls, emails, and paperwork ensue. The Oculus team is told to stand down. The ops room are sheepishly informed that there's nothing to see here. The code blue is cancelled, and I get a huge black mark for budget overspend on my departmental project matrix. There's even a post-mortem meeting scheduled for the day after tomorrow to rub it in.
Incident 2911.1-A, code blue / misidentification walkthrough, pops up in my calendar. The thing is, it is technically a misfire. Very nearly a blue-on-blue incident. Mary and her charismatically intense boss, Oscar, assure me that there is no ongoing campaign of exsanguination and hemophagia by the Scrum. Everything is copacetic with HR regarding their induction as the Laundry's newest and most sparkly high-end formal Logic Brains trust. Even though her little playmates have developed super strength and a disturbing tendency to burst into flames if they go outdoors in daylight, who am I to shout vampire in a crowded graveyard? Fuck it. She always was better than me at administrative/managerial manoeuvring. As witness, her success in leveraging the fallout from our outfalling to get herself semi-permanently outplaced to a company where she probably earns more in a month than I take home in a year. I am certainly not stupid enough to insist on blowing the whistle on her little white lie about the V-word when a fangfucker, okay, a temporarily photophobic math PhD with the strength of a rabid grizzly bear, is resting his hands on my shoulder as I countersign the necessary paperwork to certify that said fangfucker is one of our people. For whatever value of people you choose to use. In any case, in the Laundry, we tend to take a rather looser definition of the word than is the norm elsewhere. Here's the situation as I understand it at this point. Mary may have a history of periodically going off the deep end and throwing boots at my head, but she was never an idiot. She worked for the Laundry full-time on the admin side for 2 or 3 years before her sideways shift into investment banking. She knows exactly how the Laundry goes about dealing with outbreaks, and she knows that our three priorities are the three C's: containment, confidentiality, and capabilities. We contain outbreaks, maintain confidentiality, and enhance our capabilities. The Scrum's new and fascinating breakthrough is certainly an enhanced capability, so she knew that as long as she could maintain confidentiality and do something to contain it, she could wrap it all up in a bow, with the right forms filled out in triplicate and signed in blood, and hand them over to HR. And as soon as she realized she could talk about us to Oscar, the confidentiality gesh apparently doesn't work too well on people who've contracted her unfortunate condition, she briefed him, called up her contacts in HR, and set all the wheels in motion to position her team on the inside of the tent pissing out, rather than vice versa. At which point the outbreak of K-syndrome that sucked me into searching out the Scrum stopped from being an external threat to be addressed and turned into a fucking inside job. Which neatly explains why my warrant card didn't work on Alex. As a barely across the threshold new employee, he was nevertheless permitted to see it for what it was. The gesh on our ID cards doesn't affect our own people. And yes, in case you were wondering, this is my angry and disgusted face with egg dripping down it.